very nice to be back at Perimeter. I spent 9 months here, last academic year. I was going to make a joke, actually, about the fact that if you spend long enough in Perimeter, wherever else you go and you give a talk, you feel a bit nervous because you're not close to a hockey stick. Then I noticed there wasn't one here, so. It's especially an honor for me to speak after Julian Barber. I mean, in a sense, my talk is going to be a footnote to his talk. Julian had an enormous impact on my own understanding of philosophy of physics, and in particular, the understanding of space and time. So a lot of the themes that I'll be raising today, I think, are consonant with the kind of approach that Julian has been defending so well over the last few decades. Well, I'm going to start with the theme, what is a clock? And again, this is carrying on from what Julian was saying before. Clocks really have, in a sense, three aspects in physics. They tick in some sense of the word, periodically. But normally, you need to be able to count the ticks to say how much duration has passed. So we need to know what those notions mean, particularly periodicity. And this is something, of course, that Julian just described in his talk when he was defending the idea of a dynamical notion of time and therefore clocks. We often say that clocks measure time insofar as they're well-defined, and this is a very natural terminology, but the idea that of the clock that Julian was defending, which is that it's some device that ticks in consonance with ephemeris time or the time defined by the total dynamical system, this notion of marching in step with time is a correlation. It's not really a measurement. It's not a measurement in the sense that we often talk about in quantum mechanics when we talk about the measurement problem, where we have a dynamical interaction between systems. And I just stress this right from the beginning because we'll see later when we talk about the clock hypothesis, it's very easy to get confused about this in relativity theory. Clocks don't actually measure anything. They correlate with some standard, which is given by the structure of the dynamical theory. But they don't measure in the sense, they're not like thermometers. They don't interact with the system, at least not in some intrinsic way. Then I want to say something about time dilation and the clock hypothesis. And again, all of these things from the point of view of quantum mechanics. I'll just mention one or two aspects of quantum mechanics that impinge on this aspect. What happens to the behavior of a moving clock is given by Einstein's special theory of relativity. Of course, there's a third aspect of a clock, and that is its phase. And Julian mentioned Poincaré's original recognition that there is something conventional about the way we introduce simultaneity into the definition of inertial frames. What does that mean? From the point of view of a clock, it's simply saying how we connect the phase of a clock here with the phase of a distant clock. And I think myself, Poincaré was right. There is, in an important sense, a degree of conventionality about this. In fact, it was that very notion of a certain degree of conventionality about how we synchronize distant clocks and how we define simultaneity at a distance that made Einstein's discovery of the relativity of simultaneity conceptually palatable to Einstein himself. I think it's fair to say that the last step in the derivation and understanding of the Lorentz transformations, the 1905 paper, began to make sense to him. The relativity of simultaneity made sense to him when he realized that even with respect to a single frame, there's a sense in which, an interesting sense in which, the very notion of simultaneity between distant events is conventional. There's no matter of fact as to whether these events are strictly simultaneous. This has given rise, of course, in the literature on the philosophy of time, an immense literature. Probably the thing that's most produced the spilling of ink. But today I won't have time to talk about that. I want to stick to the first two issues. So we come to the issue that Julian stressed in his talk. What is duration? And as Arthur Mill once put it, we cannot catch a fleeting minute and put it alongside a later minute. How do we know that two intervals of time are the same? One person who was concerned about this, roughly the same time that Poincaré was writing about the conventionality of duration, and here I think the conventionality of duration is much less, the conventional nature of duration is much less appealing than, say, the conventional nature of distant simultaneity. In an unpublished paper written in his lifetime, just before his premature death, George Francis Fitzgerald, of the famous Fitzgerald-Lorentz contraction fame, wrote a very nice essay on units and measurement and physics, and was concerned with the problem about the fact that the rotation of the Earth in sidereal time was really the best, the rotation of the Earth was the best clock available to physics at the time. And he says, there is every reason for assuming that the Earth rotates on its axis more uniformly than any clock we can construct. But then, of course, there is a conceptual puzzle. We know on theoretical grounds that the rotation, and to some extent empirical grounds, that the rotation must be changing. If you use the rotation of the Earth and you extrapolate backwards, you get the wrong dates for the eclipses in ancient times. This is something that Fitzgerald mentions. We also know that the Earth is not a perfectly rigid body. It's a very complicated body. It's got oceans sloshing on the surface. These things are affected by tidal forces, of course. Friction is being produced. Heat is being radiated into the atmosphere and so on. Surely this is going to affect the clock as a uniformly rotating body. And nowadays we know that the rotation of the Earth is so immensely complicated to predict, it's impossible actually to predict. It's not just, of course, the tides on the surface of the Earth, it's all kinds of internal dynamics of the Earth itself, the internal structure of the Earth. And I think normally the Earth tends to slow down, but I think in the last decade it's turned out that the Earth has started to speed up again. But this thing is totally unpredictable. But the question that Fitzgerald raised was, how on Earth can we discover a change in our standard itself? How do we find a more ultimate standard of time? And here, he was basically raising the question that Poincaré raised. And let me start by comparing Einstein first with what might be called a dynamical picture. You will all know that in the 1905 relativity paper, Einstein makes very, very important use of the existence of ideal clocks. In fact, he defines time in terms of ideal clocks. So let's say, according to Einstein, that what we mean by duration is that defined by ideal clocks. But of course, this raises the question, again, what is an ideal clock? Now, I've heard Julian many times say, Einstein does not tell us what a clock is. And that's certainly the case in 1905. There's no indication as to how you define an ideal clock. It's, as it were, given from above. But in 1910, Einstein made the following remark about defining an ideal clock. By a clock, we understand anything characterized by a phenomenon passing periodically through identical phases, so that we must assume by virtue of the principle of sufficient reason that all that happens in a given period is identical with all that happens in an arbitrary period. Was that easy to understand? The trouble with the principle of sufficient reason is it depends on whose reasoning it is. You might find somebody, for example, who finds it very, very difficult to explain on a priori grounds, for example, why the clock on your wrist is a better timekeeper than, say, your heart. Of course, in a sense, what Einstein is saying, I think really, and it could be interpreted as the dynamical theory, he just doesn't put it that way. It's much clearer when we go to Newton, Fitzgerald, Poincaré, Julian's work. What is duration? Well, this is a dynamical notion. And it's the choice of the temporal parameter that makes the basic laws of physics take their simplest form. It's something that's defined by the very dynamics of the theory, the fundamental theory of the universe itself. Newton himself, as Julian mentioned, remarked in the Principia, in the Scholem to the Principia, there may be no such thing as an equable motion. And I think Newton was thinking of the inertial body as defining a clock because it's moving equal distances and equal times. It's ticking in that sense. But of course, nature doesn't equip us with ideal clocks in this sense. We simply don't find inertially moving bodies in the universe. We find approximations to them. From this point of view, if a clock has to be isolated in order to march in step with, say, ephemeris time and, say, the Newtonian dynamics of point particles or the celestial mechanics or whatever, then the clock has to be isolated, and the only isolated system in the universe is the universe. So I'm spelling out what Julian was saying, was that the ultimate clock is the universe itself. Now, what about in quantum mechanics? In quantum mechanics, it's been recognized ever since the work of Schrodinger and Pauli in particular, that if you want to have an ideal clock, the ideal clock, that thing which marches in step with the temporal parameter that appears in the most fundamental equation, which is the time-dependent Schrodinger equation, that temporal clock will have to have a Hamiltonian whose spectrum is unbounded. So it is not bounded from below. This has been widely known in the literature on quantum mechanics, and a very elegant version of this no perfect clock theorem was published in 1989 by Unruh and Wald. In fact, a very similar kind of argument was found earlier, 1969, in a paper by Alcock, and I thank Jos Ufing for putting me onto this paper by Alcock. And essentially, the argument goes something like the following. I don't really want to get into details, but it goes something like the following. Suppose there's an observable T represented by a self-adjoint operator, so it has a real spectrum. Say it has a continuous spectrum, and the values of T are going to increase monotonically with the temporal parameter T that appears in the Schrodinger equation, the time-dependent Schrodinger equation. And for the sake of argument, let's split up this continuous spectrum into equal intervals. So here's the spectrum of T. We split up the spectrum into equal intervals. We consider this interval marked by N, this by M. And we consider an eigenstate, a state of the system which is an eigenstate of the projection operator on the nth interval. And what we want to say is something like the following. These are minimal conditions for thing being an ideal clock. They're necessary but not sufficient. We want to say that there's a non-vanishing probability that if the state of the system is Tn, that it's going to progress forwards in time to Tm, where m is greater than n. But we also want to impose, and this is a very strong condition, because it holds for all n and m, we want to impose that the possibility of going backwards in time with respect to the T associated with the Schrodinger equation is zero. Well, then we can construct a function, a complex function, which is basically the overlap of one of these states with the evolved version of another one of these eigenstates of the projection operator. And it turns out that this function, this complex function, is holomorphic. If we treat the T here, we can treat this function as being a function of a complex variable for the sake of argument. This is a I beg your pardon. It's my fault. These should be T's. Thank you. Well, it turns out that if we use, we can show that this function is holomorphic on the appropriate half-complex plane. We then use the uniqueness theorem for the continuation of analytic functions from their boundary values to show that there cannot be any such self-adjoint operator T, the time, as it were, the time variable, that has these properties. because otherwise we're going to get an inconsistency with the analytic properties of that function. If, that is, the energy is bounded from below. If the energy is bounded from below. Now, why do we want the energy bounded from below? Presumably for reasons of stability. If the system is totally isolated, well, then there's no problem with having an unbounded energy spectrum because we could start with a state of the system which, in which the average value of the energy is finite and it stays that way forever if it's completely isolated. But for real systems, we want their energies to be bounded from below simply because we don't want them to be an infinite source of energy when they interact with the environment. So the no perfect clock theorem in quantum mechanics works, and it essentially works by appealing to systems which are not essentially isolated. In other words, real systems. But the question that I want to raise here is anything going on here in quantum mechanics that's essentially different from what we've seen in classical mechanics? In classical mechanics, we're also aware of the fact that if you define time in this dynamical way that Julian was proposing, if you have completely isolated systems like free particles, you can define an ideal clock. But of course, the problem is you don't find them in nature. Anything other than an isolated system will not march absolutely in step with the time given by that dynamical theory. But that doesn't mean that we can't construct a very good approximate clocks. And there's nothing in this argument that tells us also, and Pauli made this point, there's nothing in this argument also that tells us that we can't construct very good approximate clocks in quantum mechanics. Now, you might say that there is another difference, because even if you take an isolated system and you say, I don't care about the energy spectrum being bounded from below, there is a thing called the quantum recurrence theorem that was originally published by Bocchieri and Luenge in 1957, which tells us that if we have a system that has a discrete energy spectrum, that system, over given long enough periods of time, will return arbitrarily close to its initial state. So this is the quantum mechanical version of the Poincaré recurrence theorem that holds for measure-preserving flows in finite measure phase spaces in classical mechanics. And the theorem is relatively straightforward. If we start with a system, we can always express it as a linear combination of energy eigenstates. The state can always be expressed as a linear combination of energy eigenstates. We then apply the unitary evolution of the Schrodinger equation. The solution, of course, is given here, where these are the ENs, are the energy eigenstates, eigenvalues associated with these eigenstates. And then if we take the norm of the difference between the evolved state and the initial state for some time capital T, we can write that the norm of that difference in this expression. And then it turns out, within the theory, the mathematical theory of almost periodic functions, that we can find a T such that this is less than any arbitrary finite number, which is telling us that we can find a T in which the system very nearly recurs. And that's going to be inconsistent, if this is a clock, for example, with the monotonicity requirement that goes into all of these no perfect clock theorems. Should that be a concern to us? Well, it should be no more of a concern than the Poincaré recurrence theorem is in classical mechanics for the possibility of constructing ideal clocks or accurate clocks. And that's not much. We're not concerned in classical mechanics about the Poincaré recurrence theorem, essentially because we're not concerned with periods of time that are that long, and for all kinds of reasons. So it seems to me that essentially what we see in quantum mechanics with the no the no perfect clock theorem, the application of the quantum recurrence theorem, that there's nothing here that's really different from what we've already seen in the case of classical mechanics and the difficulty of constructing perfect clocks, insofar as we define them in this particular dynamical way. Just before I leave the question of duration, I just wanted to stress one thing about the nature of the time-independent Schrodinger equation, which is the equation that ultimately defines time in this dynamical sense. If we consider a free particle in quantum mechanics, and we think of, say, more or less localized wave packet, a Gaussian wave packet that's completely free, this is, of course, an idealization, as I mentioned before, then we can use that in a clock in roughly speaking the same way that we use a free particle in classical mechanics. Because, let's say, the center of mass of that particle will propagate with a uniform speed. We could, in principle, also, I suppose, look at, if we take a stationary wave packet, we could see how fast it expands. Now, the expansion of the width of the wave packet actually depends quadratically on t. So it won't be a monotonic increase, but nonetheless, for certain ranges, periods of time, it might be a reasonably good clock. We simply take this, our quantum mechanical particle, we look how quickly it expands in space, and we use that as a temporal measure. Of course, these things are idealized in exactly the same way that the free particles in classical mechanics are idealized clocks. I want to mention one other aspect. Of course, the expansion of the wave packet in quantum mechanics, non-relativistic quantum mechanics, depends on the mass. And this is a very remarkable thing, because this is the motion of a free particle, and yet part of its behavior depends on its mass. And this is something that, at first sight, looks very much out of kilter with our Galilean notions of the issue of freely moving bodies and their mass-independent behavior. I'd like also to mention that it's well known, for example, that in the case of the evolution of the system, of a free system, if we apply Noether's theorem to the symmetry associated with the Schrodinger equation, which is invariance with respect to a transformation of the wave function given by a global phase transformation, and we use Noether's theorem, of course, the corresponding conserved quantity is the integral of psi squared dx. And this is not altogether surprising if one thinks that, of course, the wave function has, in some sense, a probabilistic meaning. And this is necessary for us to be able to apply the notion of probability consistently over time. There's another application of Noether's first theorem to the free particle equation of motion, because the free particle equation of motion can be written as d by dt of I h bar psi equals where this might be considered a density, and this a free current, and this is exactly a continuity equation. So the Schrodinger equation for a free particle takes the form of a continuity equation. And we know from Noether's theorem that the theorem has an inverse. That's to say, if we have a symmetry, we can derive a continuity equation, but it works the other way around. So let's ask ourselves, what is the symmetry associated with that continuity equation? And the symmetry turns out to be the transformation of the wave function. By the way, this all depends, of course, on the fact that there is a Lagrangian formulation of non-relativistic quantum mechanics. But the symmetry here is associated with a transformation where we simply add an arbitrary complex number a constant complex number to the wave function. This will not preserve its square integrability, but it's a perfectly well-defined continuous transformation. And it's this infinitesimal continuous transformation that's associated, that symmetry that's associated with that continuity equation. What is the conserved charge? Well, we know that we can go from a continuity equation to a conserved charge by introducing certain boundary conditions. And if it turns out that the amplitude of the wave function falls off with distance faster than x to the minus 2, then the conserved quantity is no longer the integral of psi squared dx, it's the integral of psi. That's a conserved quantity if it's well-defined. So if that boundary condition is satisfied, the integral of the wave function over space is conserved. And that's the conserved charge that's associated with that symmetry with respect to the first Noether theorem. I mentioned this simply to stress that the free Schrodinger equation has some very non-trivial properties to it. And it poses a challenge for us to understand how this can be if we interpret the wave function purely as information. Now, I'm not saying that this is a difficulty, for example, for, say, the Rob Speckens approach, the epistemological approach to quantum mechanics, but I think it is a difficulty for some versions of interpretations of quantum mechanics in which the wave function is considered to be the result of what happens when you prod a system. It's the information that you get back. It's the back reaction of the system on the observer when some kind of prodding or probing or measuring takes place. And I stress that this, of course, is all taking place. This conserved entity over time, the fact that the wave function spreads in a way that depends on its mass, all of these rather surprising properties are taking place for a system that is not being prodded. System is just evolving under its own steam. Now I'd like to go on to the second notion of duration, time dilation. Well, you all know how to define time dilation in the standard way. You're comparing proper time of a single clock associated with two events, like, say, the passage of the top clock above each of the stationary clocks, with a coordinate time read off by the two stationary clocks, that time interval between the events, that are suitably synchronized. And so time dilation, as it's standardly defined in special relativity, of course, involves three clocks and not two, because it involves two stationary synchronized clocks, and the time dilation factor will depend on how you synchronize the clocks. And again, insofar as Poincaré is right about a conventionality of distance simultaneity, there will be a conventional nature, a conventional aspect to time dilation. But what's rather nice is that we can find, well, before I go on, premonitions of time dilation. Of course, the universal phenomenon of time dilation was a prediction that Einstein made. And as a consequence of the Lorentz transformation, suitably operationally interpreted, 1905. But he wasn't the first to see that at least certain kinds of clocks are going to dilate. Joseph Larmor, in 1897, had realized, basically by using an application of what was later called Lorentz's theorem of corresponding states, but essentially within an electrodynamical system, if you have two charges that are in mutual orbit, opposite sign charges that are rotating around each other, the period of rotation will depend on whether or not that system is in rest or in motion. And indeed, a time dilation factor, which is given by the standard gamma factor, will appear for the system of rotating charges. Lorentz himself, only a couple of years later, this is before the turn of the century, was puzzling over a variation of the Michelson-Morley experiment that had been suggested by Leonard, which is what would happen if you did the Michelson-Morley experiment, this time immersed in some transparent medium with a non-trivial refractive index. Now, of course, by 1889, it had become widely accepted that the explanation of the standard null result of the lack of the shift of the fringes when the system is rotated was due to the Fitzgerald-Lorentz deformation of the rigid body that holds the interferometer together. And Leonard and Lorentz realized that if you had all of this happening inside a transparent body, where the refractive index is not equal to 1, then the Fitzgerald-Lorentz deformation hypothesis, some usually called contraction erroneously, the deformation hypothesis is not sufficient to save the day. You will not predict a null result. You need something more. Now, it's interesting that instead of Lorentz using this as yet another possible test for the motion through the ether, Lorentz had already convinced himself that no second-order effects were possible, ether wind effects were possible, and now looked for a mechanism that would explain why you would get a null result. And it turned out that what he showed, and then later showed that this was an electrodynamical phenomenon, was that the electrons inside the light source, the oscillating electrons that are producing the electromagnetic radiation, their period will be changed by motion through the ether. Now, what does that motion mean? It really means with respect to the original frame relative to which Maxwell's equations are defined. Of course, this is a way of understanding time dilation that's apparently at first sight rather different from Einstein's. Because you're looking at the internal dynamics of very specific rods and clocks. And so this raises the question, how do we explain time dilation? Well, you could say it's a consequence of Einstein's 1905 principles. But it's increasingly understood these days that the Einstein 1905 paper has its limitations. It was explicitly based on a thermodynamic template. It's a so-called principle theory rather than a constructive theory. And it might be interesting to look for a more fundamental derivation. In exactly the same way that we try to explain thermodynamic processes by appealing to the kinetic theory of gases or the statistical mechanics rather than just the phenomenological laws of thermodynamics. Well, if you look in Minkowski's famous September 1908 paper, exactly 100 years to this month, and many celebrations and conferences have been taking place in honor of Minkowski's famous paper, you will find an argument to the effect that you will not understand length contraction, and I think he would also say time dilation, unless you think about it geometrically within the four-dimensional metric continuum that he was introducing. And interestingly, Minkowski himself never understood the dynamical underpinnings of the Fitzgerald-Lorentz deformation hypothesis that both Fitzgerald and Lorentz introduced. Their hypothesis was not entirely ad hoc. They were using properties of Maxwell's equations, and effectively, we would say nowadays, the Lorentz covariance of Maxwell's equations, to predict that electromagnetic bodies, at least, and possibly other bodies that have similar kinds of forces, will inevitably contract, and clocks will inevitably dilate. So maybe if you accept Minkowski's approach, you rather overlook all this dynamical past and you overlook Einstein's derivation, and you say, well, maybe there's something about space-time as a constructive entity, as a fundamental thing that explains these effects. But then you remember, as Pauli reminded us early on in his famous encyclopedia paper on relativity, however you like to describe it, it will not take place unless the forces of cohesion between the microscopic parts of rods and clocks are Lorentz covariant. So we're back to this dynamical issue again. An appeal, so therefore maybe we want to understand time dilation ultimately by appeal to a structural property in the very dynamics, the equations of the fundamental quantum theory of matter, quantum field theory eventually. Well, as you know, as many of you know, John Bell, for example, suggested a kind of a Lorentzian pedagogy that has nothing to do with the existence of a preferred frame or absolute motion or anything like that, but simply a way of understanding how these phenomena generically arise by looking at detailed models of things like little atoms, electrodynamic atoms, and so on, and motion, and solving Maxwell's, essentially solving Maxwell's equations, and deriving, just on the basis of calculations done with a single frame, no appeal to coordinate transformations or anything like that, how these phenomena arise. We need not accept Lorentz's philosophy to accept the Lorentzian pedagogy. Its special merit is to drive home the lesson that the laws of physics in any one reference frame, those are the laws that govern the forces of cohesion of these bodies, account for all physical phenomena, including the observations of moving observers. And so length, contraction, and time dilation will come out in the wash. But will they? The little model that Bell gave was a classical model of an atom with a relatively heavy positive nucleus and a negative charged particle in orbit. You solve Maxwell's equations, you use the relativistic connection between momentum and velocity and so on, and then you predict a change, say, in the period of the atom as it's being gently accelerated. And this is something that's already more or less implicit, for example, in Heaviside's work that was so influential in Fitzgerald's original idea of space deformation in rigid bodies. But of course, Bell is perfectly aware that this won't do because this is a model that's not stable. The whole point of quantum mechanics, the origins of quantum mechanics historically, was to provide a theory of stable matter. And Bell simply says at one stage, look, of course, I really need to replace this by quantum theory of these microscopic constituents of a rigid body and the rigid body eventually as a whole, but everything will come out in the wash as long as the equations are Lorentz covariant. Is that really true? Well, there are papers in the literature over the last couple of decades in which, for example, a very careful analysis is made of the quantum mechanics of decaying particles. And the relativistic quantum mechanics of decaying particles. And the claim is made that when these particles are in motion, their decay rates and lifetimes are affected not exactly by the Lorentz gamma factor, as you would naively expect. Not exactly. But there's going to be a very tiny modification. And I was hoping that for this talk I would be able to give you a report on these papers, but I'm sorry to say that I have not understood them. I can't even see in these papers, I'm not saying that they're necessarily wrong, but I cannot see a common thread as to why you would expect to see a very small deviation from time dilation. So I hope at some stage I can say something more positive about this. I'm going to leave this in abeyance. Perhaps if somebody here knows a little bit more about this, I'd be very grateful to hear it. But I want to go finally on to the third notion of duration, and which is the following. As I'm walking here on this platform, I'm aging less than you are, which is a very pleasant thought. And if I keep going forever, I'll continue to age less. But eventually, I'll either hit the wall, which is not very nice, or I won't be able to come back and rub your nose in it. So I better come back and do a kind of a round trip. But of course, that means I accelerated. Now, how do I apply special relativity to the case of an accelerating clock? And of course, this is exactly the case that Einstein himself mentioned in his 1905 paper. When you have two clocks that have relative motion but define a closed path in space-time, at least one of the clocks has to accelerate. And Einstein used this famous example of clock retardation by applying the time dilation formula. It's sometimes referred to as the clock paradox. Of course, there's no paradox at all. But it does mean that if we're going to explain this, and of course it could be that both clocks are accelerating, it doesn't really matter. As long as they don't have exactly the same kind of path in space-time, they could have exactly the same acceleration modes. But as long as there's a difference in the paths in space-time, what the clock is essentially doing, according to this idea, is it's simply measuring the proper time integrated along the path. And the proper time is given by, of course, the integration of the little ds, the Minkowski metric form, along the path. But we have to be careful. Special relativity, and in particular the Lorentz transformations, have to do with uniformly moving clocks. They tell us that uniformly moving clocks will undergo a time dilation. What happens when we have an accelerating clock? And of course, as Eddington nicely put it, we may force the accelerating clock into its track by continually hitting it, but that may not be good for its timekeeping qualities. How do we know in general that a clock will, and by the way, if you're going to make a connection between the integral of ds along a path and proper time, that's to say the time that's actually read by the clock, if you want to make that identification, what you have to assume is that at every instance, the effect of the motion on the clock is purely due to its instantaneous velocity and not its acceleration. That's the fundamental assumption. The acceleration on the clock has no effect on its timekeeping, only its instantaneous velocity through time dilation. If you don't have that, you can't really introduce the integral of ds along the path and associate that with proper time. And how do you do this? Well, sometimes in the literature you come across a thing called the clock hypothesis, which is a horrible misnomer. Because it's not quite clear what the hypothesis is. Is the hypothesis that there will be such clocks? Well, then it's true. But it's not very enlightening. And the question is, don't we really have to do some kind of dynamical study of a particular clock to see how big, for example, the internal restorative forces of the clock are to the external forces, the hitting forces that Eddington is talking about, that give it the acceleration? If I take a pendulum clock, for example, and I walk around with it in this room, it's not going to be a very good clock. And those of you who know, who have read the book Longitude will know that the history of maritime navigation, it was really, in a sense, in part, the history of searches for a clock that you could put into a ship in order to calculate longitude that would basically continue to read time under all kinds of motions, irregular motions, and so on inside the ship. Well, in 1960, you will know that, and here I've got, I'm very close to finishing, Pound and Rebke, of course, had announced that they were going to do the famous gravitational redshift experiment by having, by appealing to the Mossbauer effect for the emission and absorption of a gamma ray by iron 57 nuclei. And so you had an emitter and an absorber at opposite ends of a tower, 60-foot tower, and you wanted to calculate the effect of the acceleration of the tower, because of course, according to the principle of equivalence, or according to general relativity, the tower is accelerating with respect to the local inertial frames. That's going to create a redshift in the radiation, and therefore there should be a mismatch between the frequency of emission and the frequency of absorption. The Mossbauer effect is so fantastically precise that you won't get resonance absorption, and therefore you've got to introduce a compensating Doppler effect by moving the absorber relative to the detector. And that's exactly what they did, and they showed that indeed they had to introduce a motion a relative motion between the absorber and the detector inside the tower in order for the resonance absorption to take place. And this is exactly in consonance with the prediction from on the basis of the principle of equivalence, or simply the claim that the tower itself that's rigidly on top of the surface of the Earth is actually accelerating with respect to the local inertial frames. But what they realized before they did the experiment, and this is something that Josephson independently pointed out, was the following. These nuclei inside the lattice, this piece of iron, are jiggling around because of just thermal agitations. And there's a root mean speed of something like 10 to the 4 centimeters per second. There is also, if treated as linear harmonic oscillators, there's an acceleration of something like 10 to the 16 G. Now, if there's a temperature difference between the emitter and the absorber, you have essentially a problem of time dilation over and above the effect of the acceleration. And in fact, they calculated on the basis of special relativity, and this was the first time, by the way, that something like the clock hypothesis, I beg your pardon, the clock retardation effect for a closed motion for two clocks was actually verified experimentally. What they showed was that even if there's a temperature difference of 1 degree between the emitter and the absorber inside the tower, there will be an effect due to time dilation that will be roughly equal to the predicted effect in general relativity due to the gravitational redshift. So they had to introduce either very, very tight temperature controls, or they had to compensate for the temperature difference. At any rate, they did measurements for temperature differences and confirmed the time dilation effect to, I think, 1 part in 10 to the 3. And the question is, why is this happening? In other words, they confirmed that the clocks associated with these nuclei, even though they were accelerating by a factor of 10 to the 16 times the gravitational acceleration, the effects on those clocks did not only depend on their instantaneous velocities and not the accelerations. And the question is why? So we know that these things are good clocks from the point of view that they satisfy the clock hypothesis has been tested. And there's a very nice paper by Sherwin in 1960, the same year, in which he points out that you can do a simple, straightforward calculation about the structure of the nucleus. And he notes that, noting that electric forces which cause the acceleration act only on the protons, we find that under acceleration of about 10 to the 16 G, the neutron and the proton components of the nucleus should suffer a maximum relative displacement of about 1 part in 10 to the 13 of the nuclear diameter. Even using the great sensitivity of the Mossbauer resonance, such a small distortion is not likely to produce an observable effect. He goes on to say that, well, maybe there could be other circumstances in which you would see the effect of acceleration, because the effect of the acceleration would be such as to disrupt the internal structure of the nucleus. But we haven't seen those yet, certainly in this particular experiment. So we have a way of understanding why it is that these clocks do, in fact, satisfy the clock hypothesis. How much longer do I have? Probably minus something. Okay. Well, just finally, I'd like to mention another experiment, probably more famous for testing the clock retardation effect and therefore time dilation. You'll recall that in 1977, in the muon storage ring at CERN, experiments were done with decaying muons, and they could compare the muon decay rate for gamma factor. These are ultra-relativistic particles inside these rings. The gamma factor is roughly 30. And they were able to confirm that muon decay suffers a time dilation in motion to an accuracy of 10 to the third, and now the accelerations are 10 to the 18 g. And again, wouldn't it be nice to know why it is that this is the case? In other words, it really shouldn't be regarded as a clock hypothesis. It should be that we can look at the dynamics of these systems and see what, how likely it is that they are going to be consistent with the so-called clock hypothesis. And there's a paper in 1987 by Eisel, who does a calculation in the weak interaction theory for decaying muons, and after a very complex, detailed calculation, finds that the correction due to motion within a uniform magnetic field that's perpendicular to the direction of motion of the muons is going to be something like 1 part in 10 to the minus 10 to the 25. So again, a dynamical account is given as to why the muons themselves seem to satisfy the so-called clock hypothesis. He ends his paper with the following remark. A more speculative extension of our considerations to the very extreme conditions of astrophysics. Near radio pulsars, magnetic fields up to 2 to 10 to the 13 Gauss are expected to exist. Well, under these circumstances, there could be muons where we could see a correction that's now 1% rather than the tiny correction that he calculated for the muons in the muon storage ring. And this is an interesting example of a situation where, well, there may well be circumstances in which relativistic clocks will not satisfy the clock hypothesis. There are others also in the literature. But he says, the most important part of this calculation surely consists not in any possible application like this, but rather in the possibility in principle to verify the clock hypothesis in this special case with the help of an accepted physical theory. So I'm going to end with a note that goes back to Bell again. When Bell was talking about special relativity, he made the following remark, slightly uncanny. If you are, for example, quite convinced of the second law of thermodynamics, of the increase of entropy, there are many things you can get directly from the second law, which are very difficult to get directly from a detailed study of the kinetic theory of gases. But you have no excuse for not looking at the kinetic theory of gases to see how the increase of entropy actually comes about. In the same way, although Einstein's theory of special relativity, and in particular the 1905 paper where he derives the Lorentz transformations based on his phenomenological postulates, the relativity principle, the light postulate, and the isotropy of space, although Einstein's theory of special relativity would lead you to expect a Fitzgerald contraction, and one could also say time dilation, you are not excused from seeing how the detailed dynamics of the system also leads to these effects. Now, Bell was talking here about the effects associated with uniformly moving bodies, but this is especially the case when it comes to accelerating bodies. One has to should do a detailed analysis of these bodies to see to what extent that they're consistent with the so-called clock hypothesis, and ultimately, of course, this means quantum mechanical analysis. Thank you.
Does that work?
I have one historical question, and then it may be in relation to other connection to the main physical question. You said that Heinstein had difficulty with defining a clock. But for me, he has this axiom that the velocity of light is constant. So we have this clock, which is a light clock. Put a pulse of light going between two mirrors with equal distance. This supposed defined a clock in a robust way. And this is also related to your discussion of this twin paradox and acceleration. If we make a twin paradox, which is very very long, acceleration period is very tiny, so it doesn't make any effect, essentially. So we don't need to discuss acceleration. Also, if I understand my clock as a light clock, I know exactly what's going on there, and if I do it very fast, I have no, essentially, acceleration will not change my result. So what I teach in my courses is that if I have clocks which move, they have the same time dilation as clock which going to clocks which accelerate, they have the same time dilation which clock which move with constant velocity. Clearly, if I have clock which is not constructed well and forces will break it down, so it's not a good clock.
Far be it for me to say, Lev, that what you say in your lectures is not true, strictly. And I think I couldn't, you'll have to just repeat, could you just repeat, what was the nature of the clock that you mentioned that wouldn't suffer effects due to acceleration? Right. Yeah, thank you. Okay, the famous Langevin light clock. But of course, that's true. That could be considered an ideal clock, as long as you know what a rigid body is, or as long as you know what you mean by the distance that's preserved between the mirrors. Now, what is distance? According to Einstein, distance is measured by rods, rigid rods, and what are they? I'm simply saying that the same kinds of problems arise in both cases. He defined distance in terms of rigid bodies, and he defined time in terms of ideal clocks. And in both cases, it seems to me that it should be the other way around.
My question is basically, I guess, follows up on this other question. About 4 years ago, these two little kids did this science fair project. Basically, it was exactly what you described. It's light and trying to make a clock out of it. And what they showed, which I looked at it, I couldn't find any fault in it, is that a clock at one end of the train keeps different time than a clock at the other end of the train, although they're moving at the same velocity as long as the observer is in the middle. And I could not find any fault in their argument. And then they went on to say, because we talked about the Michelson-Morley experiment as part of this whole thing, they said, well, why don't we do the Young's double slit experiment with the Michelson-Morley? And if you do that, they were showing that you would see that you would not have a null result whatsoever, because now you're introducing quantum into relativity, and they don't work.
I think the devil's in the details, but I cannot imagine how it is that they concluded that two clocks that are at rest in the same inertial frame but at different places, how if initially they're synchronized, they don't remain synchronized. I can't imagine how that was derived. There's nothing in special relativity that would... Right. But incidentally, it's in relation to the Michelson-Morley experiment. It's got nothing to do with, strictly speaking, with the Michelson-Morley experiment as a consequence of the relativity principle, and that will hold in quantum mechanics as well as in classical dynamics. So I can't see how anything quantum mechanical is going to suggest a non-null result. Okay.
just some of the ideas that came up in my mind while you were talking is, in a sense, almost all of these discussions in relativity can also be done just in three-dimensional space. I can talk about the conventionality of the determination of the horizontal. So I've got, you know, the two horizontal dimensions, and then I've got the vertical dimension. In this case, it would be the Fitzgerald lengthening that, you know, if you tilt something which has the same delta x and delta y, and you tilt it in delta z, that somehow the rod is now longer. You lay the rods along paths that are not straight paths, and they're longer than the, you know, this is the Prince paradox, they're now longer than they are shorter. Why doesn't this whole discussion that you've been having here about conventionality, worries about duration, also apply equally well just in, you know, Euclidean measurements in space and so forth?
Good question. Maybe the following remarks will be helpful. When we're discussing the clock retardation effect of the clock paradox, we think in space-time we have two paths, time-like paths that come together. It's not required that one is inertial. They could both be accelerating. But the integral of ds along that path will be different from the integral of ds along that path. So lengths are path-dependent. And we say, for example, that this is associated with proper time because we can break this up into little straight bits, little ds's, and we can just add them. Those little ds's are given by the metric. And that's another way of saying that these little straight bits are associated with time dilation, no acceleration. And when we integrate along here, we're assuming that there are no effects due to the acceleration. It's just instantaneous velocities. But exactly the same situation arises where instead of space-time, this is space. So suppose I have, let's say, a two-dimensional surface, and I draw these lines along the surface. How do I measure the lengths? Well, come to think of it, how do you measure the length of a crooked line? What do you use? You can't use a straight rod unless it's very, very, very small. So what would you typically use? A string. Why does that work rather than a rubber band? Because ultimately, you're making the same kind of assumption. There's a complete analogy here. You're assuming that the string itself is a little bit like a bicycle chain, structurally. It's got little straight bits that don't change in length, no matter how twisted the thing becomes, which allows you to add up all those little straight bits and get a meaningful answer. So I would say that there is an analogy with the clock hypothesis in defining measuring devices for measuring crooked lines in ordinary space. I would say there's a complete analogy. If you use the wrong system, if you use something that's too rubbery, you're not going to get out the right answer, at least according to Euclidean geometry. So it seems to me there is an analogy here. I agree with you. Yeah. There it's not going to make a difference. There it is not going to make a difference because you've imposed the acceleration regime is so tiny compared to the rest of the path. I agree. But what happens in the cases where that's not true? What happens in the cases where the body is accelerating virtually throughout the entire path? Now, we know because of the first case that really this is, you know, the relativistic prediction will be associated with the summing up of instantaneous dilation effects, but that's only if we can make this assumption that the clock behaves itself. And whether the clock behaves itself depends on the dynamical considerations. I mean, it's not, one can't say a priori one way or the other.
Right.
But surely whether or not, if we want to test the theory, don't we have to look for things that are approximately good clocks? Well, I think so. We're not, as I was trying to say at the beginning of the talk, the fact that we can't create ideal clocks is not something that's particularly, I mean, it's no worse in general in quantum mechanics than it is in classical mechanics. Well, I think let me answer you in the following way. It's certainly the case that as Einstein got older and wrote about the meaning of special relativity, he distanced himself more and more from his 1905 formulation. And he stressed the fact that really what special relativity is about, it is a principal theory in the form, but it's a limited principle. It's the restricting principle to all the fundamental interactions. A Lorentz covariant. Okay, it's a theory unlike any other theory, with the exception possibly of thermodynamics, because it's a theory. It's a constraint on theories. It's a constraint on the fundamental interactions. But notice that in this formulation, the Maxwell field has no special role. He was a bit embarrassed by the role that light plays in his 1905 paper. He says, "Yes, okay, Maxwellian theory, electrodynamics, and all the rest of it was the cradle of special relativity." But it shouldn't be regarded as it were, living in the formal basis of the theory, properly understood. The theory is just a constraint on any of the fundamental non-gravitational interactions, namely Lorentz covariant. But one of the things that I think is interesting, and it comes up, for example, in these relativistic analyses of moving decaying particles, is just exactly what do you get? In the case of quantum mechanics, when you impose Lorentz covariance, do you always get exact Lorentz Einstein dilation for these systems, or do you get something close to it? After all, one thing is to talk about a structural property of the equations. Another thing is to talk about the behavior of these big messy things. Quantum mechanical clocks are not like classical clocks. If you give them a definite speed, then they're everywhere in space. In the original theory of relativity, we have clocks that are situated at definite points in space, definite events. They're synchronized. They have definite states of motion or rest. And everything, all of these things break down in quantum mechanics. And this, for example, led Schrödinger to the most awful confusions about whether or not the Lorentz transformations even apply in quantum mechanics. So, I mean, there are subtleties here.